Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Is it an issue of religious liberty or right to health care? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush, and those are just some of the questions now swirling around the Obama administration's decision to require birth control coverage by employer insurance policies under the Health Care Reform Act. After initial objections from Catholic leaders, the president offered up a compromise that would require insurance carriers to foot the bill for contraceptive coverage if the religious institution objected. But the Catholic bishops have announced a major campaign against the requirement anyway. Take a look at the issues on hand. We have in studio Susan Parker. She's an editorial writer for the Salisbury Daily Times. And by phone from Los Angeles, Maureen Pratt, syndicated columnist with the Catholic News Service. And welcome to you both. Well, I first want to sort of start out with your general impressions of this controversy. And Maureen, I want to start with you first. What is your sense about what the president did and how the Catholic bishops reacted?
Well, I support the Catholic bishops in what they have been doing and what they have been saying. I think that one of the major problems with the turn that this discussion about the Affordable Care Act has taken and some of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act really do ignore the elephant in the room, which is what really is health care and what should it be targeted at, given that budgetary restrictions already mean that not everything can be covered. And I wrote a column about that for Catholic News Service. I write a syndicated column for them. And my basic impression and what has been coming up in the discussion about the Affordable Care Act, and particularly with the mandate for contraception and sterilization coverage, is that women's health, that term, is really being co-opted for political purposes. What's being talked about as pertaining to women's health, i.e. the contraception, sterilization, the morning after pill, really have nothing to do with the major issues facing women's health in today's society.
Well, you would then really very narrowly define what is an illness or a health issue. I mean, you think that the health issues only apply then to say something like illnesses?
Well, let me give you an example. The major killer of women in the United States is not the lack of free contraception. It's heart disease. And there is a major, major need for more research specifically targeted to women and for women, because women have specific and different physiological components that men do not. And a lot of the research that's been done on heart disease up till now has been done on men. So heart disease is the number one killer of women, and we need more research, and research obviously costs money. So the dollars that are not going towards something like that or some of the other major health issues facing women, and health issues meaning things that actually affect mortality, that affect total quality of life, that affect the ability to work, the ability to be healthful, all of those things are what I put under the category of women's health. It's not just getting a cold. It's the major issues that are affecting women and women's life and death issues.
So you see this as, I mean, you see this, contraception, say, versus research for heart disease. This is a zero-sum game for you then. This is an either-or situation.
Well, I think there are other avenues open to women for getting free contraception, for one thing. Not so much with the necessary research to be able to get more effective prevention and treatment for women who have cardiovascular disease.
Susan Parkin, I want to turn to you. What's your impression of what the bishops did and then what the president did, and then respond to some of what Marina said?
Well, I think that the bishop's original response was okay. I think that there was a compromise offered. If the bishop's objection was to using their money for them to have to purchase birth control coverage, it's kind of a shell game, because the money that goes into an insurance policy, you don't track each individual dollar. And in the end, it's up to the woman who either uses or doesn't use the contraception. And so I think that the argument over hospitals and schools where employees are not necessarily Catholic and the people they serve are not necessarily Catholic is a little over the top. And I think there are ways around it. Certainly what Maureen is saying about healthcare is valid. There's lots of aspects to healthcare, but this has come up and it is an issue. And so that's sort of what we need to deal with now.
Well, what about this issue of Maureen? What about this issue of do you see this as an infringement on religious liberty?
Are you asking me?
Let me ask you first. Yeah. What?
I don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't. I see the issue as an issue of fairness, really, and an issue of government and religion and separation of church and state, which I realize there's not a so-called separation clause, but I think that the government and religion need to stay pretty separate, because it's a slippery slope when you start making exceptions. There's lots and lots and lots of religions. And when you start letting the state decide what is religion and what isn't and what they're going to make exceptions for and what they're not, there's a lot of issues about fairness there.
Maureen, what about you? Is this an issue of religious liberty?
Well, I would take a different tack on that. I'm sure that the Founding Fathers couldn't have conceived what's happening now in terms of this debate. But when you have religious freedom, and religious freedom not just to worship but to practice your faith, there's bound to be conflict when it comes to a group of people or a government that wants to control all aspects of society, including religion. And I think it's very dangerous, and certainly not what my perception of what the Founding Fathers intended, for the government to tell a religion what that religion can or cannot do within the context of its religious makeup. And when it comes to fairness, I think because we are having this debate, obviously, it does have to be addressed, but that doesn't mean that we have to become a victim to it and not look at the other things that are probably even more urgent and more important when it comes to, again, we go back to women's health. And when we talk about fairness, although within an insurance realm, each line item is not given a specific dollar amount. You know, when you look at an insurance policy you're thinking of getting, it'll say you get so much for this coverage and so much for this coverage and your copay is so much. That is usually delineated. But the dollars and cents of exactly how much is going to be allocated for the syringes to give injections and all of these things, not necessarily delineated, but those costs are figured into the premium cost. So within this mandate, insurance companies are going to have to allocate a certain amount of money for the contraception, sterilization services, and morning after pill. And so you have those dollars being figured into those costs and not going to things like a copay for a woman who has to have chemotherapy due to breast cancer, or a woman who is waiting for a lung transplant, but who still has to pay a copay for the oxygen that's keeping her alive because she has COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So you have these women having to pay out of pocket for things that are keeping them alive, and yet money being allocated in that same insurance policy that they carry that has to be put toward contraception, which they are probably not going to be using.
Susan,
they have other health issues that are more pressing.
Susan, why don't you respond to that?
Coverage is always going to include, unless you devise an a la carte exchange where you go in and say, I'm a young woman, 26 years old, and I'm probably going, that's important to me, contraceptive and reproductive care is important to me, so I want that. I don't really want this other coverage because it's not going to affect me. Unless you do that, everybody's paying for something that they're not using. If you're a single male, you don't want that kind of coverage either. You want something different, maybe for prostate cancer. So I don't think, unless we change the whole system of delivery and payment here, I don't think there's any way around that.
You see, that's the kind of conversation that is actually more constructive. Because when you think about the aging of the population also, there are going to be millions of women who have passed their reproductive years, but whose insurance policies are going to have to include this contraceptive coverage. And actually, I have to give a footnote to the thought that contraceptives are part of health care. Actually, they create more health risk, because the kind of contraceptives that would be prescribed by a doctor are not going to protect against HIV. They're not going to protect against a lot of other sexually transmitted diseases. And so they're opening the door to more problems than not. Those are the only things that are used.
Susan, I want to give you a chance to respond.
I disagree that contraceptive and reproductive care opens doors to more problems. I think that women, historically at least, sought those kinds of care when they weren't legal even, and they did it in much less safe conditions. So while I'm not advocating for either side, I don't think that's a good argument.
What contraceptives did they?
Well, they used abortions. They did back alley abortions. If they got pregnant and didn't want to be, they had no recourse. And so, also, pregnancy certainly carries, if you're just talking health wise, carries a great deal of risk on many fronts. So if the lack of contraceptives causes you to have, I don't know, an ectopic pregnancy or causes complications, you've certainly put yourself in a position health-wise for greater risk.
See, Susan just mentioned something that in my column I bring out. This talk about contraceptives being part of women's health also clouds the fact that one of the intentions is to cover abortion. You just mentioned abortion as something that women sought out before it was legal
and dangerous
for them. I don't know that abortion is on the table in terms of the Affordable Care Act right now.
No, it's not.
Okay, so when I asked you what contraceptives women sought out,
well, they didn't
before
have
they
options.
Were legal? I'm not sure about the history
of that. Let me sort of run back here just a little. First of all, matter of fact, there were bans in the various states that barred, for instance, people from actually getting contraceptives. This is prior to the 1960s. Matter of fact, the Griswold case, which established the right to privacy, was over whether or not you could bar, I think it was married couples, from getting contraceptives. That's first order business. Second order business is that when you looked at the revolution that took place with contraceptives, particularly the pill that came into existence, one of the things that happened to women is they were, for the first time, able not to have to have as many children. And I can tell you from personal experience that I had relatives who were my grandparents, grandmother, who wished for the day when she would not bear children because her husband did not believe in contraception. So contraceptives certainly have clearly had an impact in terms of the number of children, for instance, women have had, which obviously affects whether or not, if one gets pregnant, one seeks an abortion. So there is that dramatic change that takes place. In addition to which, of course, for some, there are contraceptives, by the way, particularly the pill is often used times for regulating the period, as well as some other medical issues as well. So there are issues there. But the ultimate issue in terms of being able to control how many children women have, certainly, as opposed to the risk, for instance, of childbirth. And there are risks, particularly if you have a lot of them over a period of time. It certainly seems to me to have some kind of health impact, and which is, the argument that you're making.
Well, my question, going back a few questions ago, was
sure.
Regarding what STDs and let's include HIV in there, although it's not necessarily completely an STD in the pure sense, do prescriptive contraceptions protect against?
Well, that's in some ways, that for me, that becomes sort of a separate issue, because many women who are in marriages, which are monogamous, they don't have to worry about that, and therefore, as it were, that becomes a separate issue. And you know, one can argue about whether or not if there are medical devices or whatever that can protect against, for instance, STDs. That certainly is something to look at, as opposed to narrowing it and saying, well, birth control in terms of the pill and so on is not a viable way to deal with STDs. I mean, it does seem as if there's a separate issue. But let me we've sort of been talking a little bit about the health issue. But the thing that struck me about the mandate is that basically what they said was they narrowed it to tax-exempt status that's granted through religious employers, that the main purpose of the institution is to teach religion, hires primarily people of their own faith, and serve people primarily of their own faith. And the thing that struck me about it was that here we have the church, which is entering into the marketplace. And one of the questions that's always struck me is if a religious institution believes that, for example, people should work 10 hours a day as opposed to 8 hours a day, should that then exempt them from, say, for instance, the labor laws? There is a point at which you move into the marketplace, into that secular square that we've set out, and that's where I think then the Catholic Church and other religious institutions then begin to try to grapple, as indeed the state does, with whether or not they should have, for instance, say a mandate for birth control, even if it's not funded outside the church. What about that intersection there?
Are you asking me or
yes,
Susan?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Marie.
The push and pull that I talked about earlier since the founding of the country is probably going to be with us for the duration of the existence of the U.S. And so this one issue will not settle the whole thing. There are a number of exemptions already in terms of our society that are granted to individuals as well as religious institutions, as individuals who are actively practicing a particular faith. One that comes to mind is the Amish. Individuals do not pay Social Security tax while they are working within the Amish society. There are two sides to it. There are exemptions that are already being granted under the Affordable Care Act for a number of reasons. And so why should the Catholic Church be singled out in this particular case?
Susan?
I don't think the Catholic Church is being singled out at all. I think it's very different if an Amish person says, I don't want to receive Social Security, I don't want to pay into it, it's against my religion. I don't think the employees of those religious institutions, the nurses and the teachers, are necessarily saying, I don't want that coverage, please don't make us accept it. I think there's a much easier answer to this particular dilemma, and it's not on the table, and I've never heard anyone mention it. And it's probably something that might make healthcare delivery in our country better anyway, and that would be to completely separate this issue of healthcare coverage from employment. if we could set up the exchanges that are called for in the ACA, and then if employers could do one of two things, either contribute the amount that they would have contributed in premiums to some fund in the system, or if they gave each employee the amount that they would have paid in premiums for them to go to the exchange and make their own purchase, then it would become, it would be on the individual, the conscience or the onus, to purchase what they wanted. And it would also solve some other problems that involve coming unemployed and losing your insurance, that sort of thing.
Maureen?
Well, in one sense, I agree with Susan in that I think that they're looking at enabling somebody to be covered wherever they are would be terrific. We're in a mobile society. People move all the time, and sometimes health plans are not just specific to an employer, but are specific to a state where they reside. So in that sense, it would be nice to have that part of the puzzle cleared up. I hesitate to say that that employers paying into exchanges would help this particular issue that we're talking about.
It would, however, help if they paid the individual the amount they would have paid for their premium. Then it becomes that individual's choice to purchase what they want.
Maureen?
It seems like an awful lot of money changing hands multiple times, and it would dilute the resources, I think, that would
How
be
How so? If my employer is paying $500 a month for my health care premium and I'm kicking in $200 or whatever, if that money, that extra $500, is given to me and I have that exchange to go to and purchase the coverage that I want, it's not diluting anything. The same money is going into the insurance policy. It's just that I'm making the decision about what to buy, and my employer has no responsibility for that.
Well, who is to say that you would go out and purchase insurance?
Well, then it's on me. Then I would be fined if that becomes the law, or I would be the one to suffer. I don't have to purchase it from my employer either. I can opt out of it right now. I don't have to get it at all if I don't want it. So that's not changing anything.
I guess we'll have to wait for the Supreme Court to come down.
Well, as it is now, as it stands right now, I am not forced to. And if I am mandated to, you know, the same money is paying for my health coverage, whether my employer says I'm going to offer you this one policy and I'm paying $500 a month and you're paying $200 more. And if he says, well, we're going to give you the whole $500 and you take that same $700 and you can go to that exchange and find a policy that suits you, and it's not my decision anymore. It's the same amount of money going into the system as it would be. It's just that the individual is making the decision, which I support much more than my employer choosing what I'm going to get anyway.
But then who would be running the exchanges?
Well, the state is running the exchanges. Maryland right. is getting ready to set up its exchange right now. In fact, I think the beginnings of it took place in our legislative session that just ended. So that is part of right now the ACA, was that each state was to set up an exchange. And I support that. That can continue. And then each individual would be then mandated to purchase insurance one way or the other. If you divorce it from the employer and the employer just gives you the money as part of your compensation, which it is now, it's just that you're not getting it in cash, it should be the same amount of money changing hands, and it's each individual making his or her own decision.
But we're still getting into the realm of the state in the business of insurance.
No, these are private. There is no public option. These are all private insurance companies that become part of an exchange. And they're simply offering what they offer, and you go to this central location and you choose what coverage you want from a private insurer.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
What is your position in terms of this concept of a mandate? Just in general, if we put aside
a mandate that people
that
buy,
people are required to either buy health insurance, or they certainly have to pay something to make sure that they get covered, particularly their costs, so when they do go in, as a lot of folks do, to, you know, in hospitals and so on, emergency rooms. What's your sense about the mandate?
I actually don't think that people should be forced to buy anything that they don't want, fundamentally. If they, however, end up ill, they need to pay for their care.
But if they can't?
So, if
that's if that's what we have now.
Absolutely, if they are absolutely indigent, then there should be a net to catch them, if you will. And we do have some of that now. Many hospitals will provide free care. Doctors will provide free care.
All public hospitals have to.
Insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies have things called patient assistance programs, where if a patient cannot pay for their medication, the pharmaceutical company will provide that medication for the patient. Many people aren't aware of that. So there are safety nets out there now. Are there enough of them? Probably not. But that is one of the wonderful things about the not-for-profit organizations, the faith communities, our communities that band together and help in cases where there is dire need.
Well, two things.
If we take the responsibility of taking care of people who don't have the resources in a catastrophic illness and an accident and injury or whatever might befall them, if we take that responsibility and that ability to care for them off of the shoulders of communities, faith communities, and we put it on the government, that muscle, if you will, of reaching out to other people is going to atrophy.
Susan, what would you respond?
First of all, just to comment on the faith-based help, I think if the faith-based community at large was doing an adequate job, we probably wouldn't need to have this discussion. Second of all, I wasn't really talking about those indigent people, but there are many people who do use health services and just don't pay the bill for one reason or another. And I think all of us end up paying for that. We pay for it in higher insurance premiums. We pay for it in higher hospital costs, many hidden costs. So the idea of this mandate was to make sure that everyone would have some kind of coverage. The indigent would still have the safety nets, and other people would either be paying a fine or they would be purchasing health insurance through a private company that would cover them. And this was to take some of that ease off the government, because every healthcare incident that's paid for by that private insurance is not paid for by government, and it's not paid for by all the rest of us either, through higher premiums and through higher costs in general.
I'm going to have to, we're just up on the half hour mark here, so I'm going to have to break this discussion, but it's been a very interesting discussion about faith, healthcare. We got in a little more about the healthcare system, and I want to, by the way, special thanks, by the way, to Maureen Pratt. She has joined us from Los Angeles, syndicated columnist with the Catholic News Service. Also, Susan Parker, she's the editorial writer for the Salisbury Daily Times. I'm Don Rush. You've been listening to Delmarva Today, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit pac14.org.